Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Clean Energy View radio show. Our podcasts are available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.cleanenergyview.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, or contact me directly at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at info@cleanenergyview.com. Today, my guest is Marcus Fares, and we're going to be talking about his book, Green Design, Designs for the 21st Century. As society embraces the myriad of possibilities for creating sustainability and conserving our precious resources, there are many eco-friendly products, concepts, and designs that homeowners can embrace that are good for the environment and are also aesthetically appealing. In Marcus Fares' best-selling book, Green Design, Creative Sustainable Designs for the 21st Century, there's so many innovative and creative ideas that conserve our resources while making our home environment a true work of art. So I would like to welcome to the show Mr. Marcus Fares. Good afternoon, Marcus.
Hi, June. How are you?
Fantastic, and so great to have you. Marcus, for our audience that are not familiar with your wonderful work, can you please tell our audience about yourself and also about your company?
Okay, yeah, sure. I'm a design journalist. I'm based in London, in England. I run an online architecture and design magazine called Dezeen.com, D-E-Z-E-E-N.com, and I've written a couple of books. The first was called 21st Century Design, which was a roundup of the new waves of the type of thinking, the type of aesthetics that are taking over architecture, design, and interiors as, you know, as we move into the new century. And my second book is the one you're talking about, called the English version is called Green Design. I think it's called the same thing in the States, is it? With a slightly different title in the American edition. And basically it was picking up on the whole movement driven by designers and architects, fashion designers. It covers all disciplines, interiors, products, automobiles and things like that, where the designers themselves, the architects, the creators themselves, are very much care about the planet and maybe had a bit of a crisis of confidence and thought, look, we've been part of this consumption machine. We've been designing things that are desirable for people. They want to buy them. They want to have them in their homes. They want to drive around in them. But maybe we should be trying a bit harder as a profession to make those products, those buildings, those dresses, those cars, slightly less demanding on the Earth's resources and on people's resources. So the book's about environmental sustainability, products that use recycled materials, that use less energy, that use zero energy, and also about social sustainability, of making products where the supply chain treats people better, people have a living wage, people are work in better conditions. So about, you know, redressing the imbalance between rich societies and poorer societies.
Thank you. Marcus, can you please give us your definition of green?
I think I touched on it just then. I mean, it's really about trying to usher in a new era of product, of things, whereby the impact on the environment and on the social sphere, the people that are involved in the production of objects, is lessened. I mean, eventually we all want to get to a position where there's no impact, or there's even a positive impact, where objects, by buying objects, by producing objects, we're actually making the world a better place. But don't forget, we're coming out of the 20th century, which was when manufacturing became, you know, a very sort of polluting, a very controversial and consumptive process. So we're not going to jump to a green paradise immediately. But I think green is about trying to turn the machine around, to try and start heading towards a time when human society can, in all aspects of what it does, not just in terms of products, but can start to treat the world with more care and start to redress and solve some of the problems that were created during the last century.
Thank you. For folks that are out there listening that are looking to just be more creative with materials that they would like to repurpose, do you have any advice for them as far as what some simple guidelines might be as far as creating their own flair or their own design in their home environment?
Yeah, I think so. I think something that's really important is that you can choose things that you really like. That's something that's not, you didn't buy it because it's fashionable, you didn't buy it because it's in the magazines or because your friends are talking about it. It's something you really like, and therefore you're much more likely to want to keep it for a long time. The most sustainable thing you can do is have something and keep it forever for your whole life, and maybe then hand it down to your children. And, you know, some furniture companies are doing that. They're designing things that are designed to last for hundreds of years rather than just a few years. And people can always find a new use for something that there's a favorite object. You can repurpose it. You know, if it's a sofa or an armchair, you can recover it with a new fabric. Or if it's a light and it uses expensive, you know, energy-consuming bulbs, you can change the light bulbs. So I think that would be my message. Just go for the things that you really love, and you'll find a way of making them last forever.
Thank you. Now, in the book, you spend some time talking about sun jars, which I think are absolutely magnificent, and especially any time that you can utilize anything that takes advantage of solar energy, I think it's always something that adds tremendous value, especially for the home environment. Can you explain what the designer intended to do with the sun jars? And is this something that can be taken and incorporated into other types of items that you can decorate your garden or perhaps your outdoor patio, what have you?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, lighting design is one of the areas that's changing the fastest. I mean, every year there are new breakthroughs in solar power. The sun jar is just one project, which is like a domestic object that you charge up during the daytime. This particular one is contained within a mason jar, a storage jar. And so you can leave it outside or on the windowsill during the daytime, and then at night, that energy that it absorbs is fed back out in the form of lights. So you can put them out in the garden, you can dot them around the house. They're kind of little, like candles, really, like domestic electric-powered candles. And it's very exciting. I was also in the book, there's a story about a designer called Russ Lovegrove, a British designer, who designed a solar-powered light. And since the book's gone to press, that product has become improved so much that he had one in the streets in London a few weeks ago during a design festival. And it was there. It was lighting up an entire public square. So it was absorbing the light from the sun's rays during the day and the lighting the whole square all night, every night. So these really are viable technologies now that really can make a difference.
Thank you. There's another designer that I just want to mention, Greta von Helmond, who uses sugar for jewelry. Can you talk about jewelry, and can you talk about what her work involves? I just think it's absolutely beautiful, but it's kind of ironic because it's something that I used to do as a kid with rock candy.
Yeah. So this is an interesting project. I mean, I must say, actually, that a lot of the projects in the book are experimental. The designers are trying to make a point. They're trying to research whether an idea can work or not. So some of them might seem a little bit crazy, but the point is they're trying. They're trying to change people's opinions. They're trying to test out new methodologies and new materials. Gretchen's project takes the idea of crystal, and obviously a lot of all precious stones are crystals, like diamonds and rubies and so on and so forth, the natural hard crystals that are mined from the earth. There's a lot of controversy about how those things have got out of the ground often, you know, with the stories about blood diamonds and, you know, corruptions in the States where these things are mined. But she took the notion of a crystal and thought, what else is a crystal? Sugar is a crystal. So she created a range of jewelry that's based on sugar crystals. So what she does is she suspends the thread that will form the necklace or the thread that will form the bracelet into a jar of sugar solution, and the sugar crystallizes onto the thread. Like you say, children do these experiments all the time. They teach it in schools, and came up with like a really extraordinarily beautiful series of jewelry, which looks like it's very, very precious, but of course it's very, very cheap and isn't at all durable. So it's jewelry that can only really wear once. But with this project, she was sort of questioning the whole notion of using precious limited resources from the earth to create jewelry when you could create an almost a spectacular effect using something as cheap and readily available as sugar?
I think that the fact that it is something that will not last a long time is actually not such a bad thing, considering the fact that it's something that kids, well, I remember when I was a kid I used to make rock candy, but just the whole concept of candy jewelry. I think it's a fun activity that people can do with their kids, and I think there's a great lesson there, especially when it comes to utilizing renewable resources and just creating something that's fun and enjoyable.
Exactly, yeah.
Another question that I have for you is in regards to another artist named Jasper Morrison, who designed a series of cork furniture. Now, cork seems to be a very, very popular material. Can you talk about his work and also why people really should incorporate more cork into their designs?
Well, there's a very interesting backstory to cork. Of course, there are huge cork tree plantations in Portugal and southwestern Spain in Europe, and they were planted to create corks for wine bottles. And it's a completely sustainable activity. The cork forests house all kinds of animals and creatures, and have been sustainably farmed for hundreds of years. But of course, recently, the wine industry has switched away from using cork to using metal screw-on stoppers and even plastic corks. So this has created a bit of a problem for the cork industry, and there was a danger, a fear that the cork forest would fall into disrepair, that the farmers would stop looking after them, and this amazing environmental resource would be lost. But fortunately, cork is a really beautiful material, and designers like Jasper Morrison and I are finding new ways of utilizing it. And Jasper created a range of furniture, of stools that are made of solid cork, and I mean, they're really beautiful. I mean, cork isn't something you'd think would be particularly useful for making a chair out of, but it is. And actually, even in London in this summer, every year there's a project called the Serpentine Pavilion, which a leading architect creates a pavilion outside the Serpentine Gallery in London. And this year, the entire pavilion is furnished in cork. The floors are made of cork, the walls are made of cork, and all the furniture is made of cork. So really, it's a great story of sustainability, really, like a product that looked like it was going out of fashion and was going to create a big problem for the environment in Portugal and Spain, and also for the people who have made their living from it, has now found new uses. Designers are finding new ways of using this beautiful, renewable, sustainable product and applying that to all kinds of unexpected things.
Thank you. Now, speaking of furniture, you talk about Ryan Frank's designs creating something called Strata. Can you explain what Strata is and why this is such a great concept, especially when it comes to repurposing materials that would otherwise wind up in our landfills?
Yeah, Ryan's one of a number of people, of designers, who are, like you say, taking materials, taking product that would otherwise be thrown away. Also, what you have to remember is the young designers, when they're just starting out in their careers, they often don't have access to expensive materials, they don't have access to factories, so they'll often do what they can. They'll often find things that are lying around. They'll be resourceful. Ryan's product takes unwanted office furniture that's thrown away. He finds it in the street, or he buys it from scrap dealers, and he sort of slices it up and glues it back together again to create really quite beautiful new items of furniture that very clearly sort of show the history of the objects they're made from. And I think this is quite a trend amongst designers, that you don't have to have objects, furnishings in your home or in your office or whatever that look brand new. It's nice to have a bit of wear and a bit of tear and a bit of history in them, and it's a good story. It makes an object more interesting if you can say to your friends, "And did you know this table? Look, you can see that it's made of another old table that was sawn up and repurposed, or this was made out of some office furniture that was going to be burned or sent to landfill." So it materials that have been around for a while have extra layers of character, and that gives you extra layers of story and a narrative that you can. Yeah, it gives you something more interesting to talk about.
Thank you. Let's talk about the Dutch Pavilion and its use of vertical farming. What concepts can homeowners take away from this?
Yeah, the project you're talking about was built for an expo, and the Dutch people live in a very fertile country. It's a very flat country, but they don't have an awful lot of space, so they're always looking to ways of increasing the amount of farmland they have. They've been reclaiming land from the sea for years now, but they're also experimenting with concepts like vertical farming, which is you would basically put a farm in a skyscraper. You could have, you know, like maybe cows on one level, pigs on the next level, corn on the next level. And the pavilion you're talking about was very much a kind of provocation, an experiment. But it's something that people are taking seriously because, you know, with as is more pressure on cities, as food has to travel further to get from the farm to the city, and as that raises issues about sustainability and also, you know, freshness, people are getting increasingly interested in food that's been farmed right near where they live rather than stuck in a refrigerated truck and driven across continents. So this idea of a vertical farm is one possible way that could help to solve issues of land shortage and issues of the transportation over vast distances of food. You could have a farm right in the middle of the city, is what the architects are saying in this case.
Thank you. Now, speaking of cities, Serafam has designed something called the Subway Light Project. Do you think that this could possibly, with a little bit more, input as far as how this could be more of a sustainable model in big cities like New York or London, do you think that this is definitely something that we could incorporate in the near future?
Yeah, the project you're talking about is very simple, actually. It's a subway, it's an underpass, it's a way of people
Beautiful.
Getting beneath a street in a city. And what she's done is she channels the light from the sky above into the subway. She uses fiber optics or channels or, you know, reflective passages that light can get through. It's a beautifully simple idea if you think about it, that a subway is a dark space, but, you know, a few meters above that is a bright spaces, the outdoors. So if you can get that free sunlight into the underground spaces, then you've got not only a more beautiful environment, but also a safer one, because, of course, light reduces crime. Light makes people feel happier and safer. There are all kinds of products coming onto the market now that allow you to do this in your home, that allow you to pipe light from the roof into your basement, for example. And I think that, you know, with the increase of fiber optic technology, this is going to become more widespread. I mean, if you think about it, a house or a building is a bit crazy, really, because you've got all this sunlight outside, and then you build this solid roof over the top so that none of that light can get in, and then you have to artificially light the inside of your house. So a lot of people are thinking of ways of channeling light into the home, into the, you know, the car park or the subway in this case. And you can basically get free lighting that makes everything better.
Thank you. Can you talk about what Symbios is and why this is such a very interesting method to create art while you're utilizing different elements found in nature?
Which project is that? I can't remember that one, to be honest.
Symbios is where they take the bacteria to use in different designs.
Now this is quite exciting. During the 19th and 20th centuries, industry was all about making things by basically bashing things. You bashed metal, you chopped up wood, you molded plastic. Very physical process involving raw materials, turning raw materials into finished objects. Symbios and a lot of other experiments of a similar nature are about using biological processes to create objects. The project you mentioned is a poster whereby instead of printing words onto a piece of paper, the words are grown using algae or bacteria that you coat the paper with a sugary solution, and then you spray on the bacteria, and as the bacteria eat the sugar, so they change color and you can read messages on it. But this is just the beginnings of a possible new way of creating objects or manufacturing which uses biology at the Royal College of Art degree show recently in London, somebody had proposed a factory where a very similar process was used to make little objects. They weren't objects that were useful. It was just testing out the hypothesis that maybe products could be grown, maybe bacteria or microorganisms could be used to generate products in a completely sustainable way where there's no fossil fuels are used whatsoever, no non-renewable resources are used whatsoever, and they could possibly end up in a situation where products are grown naturally.
Thank you. Now, in regards to transportation, in regards to the designers, rather the designers that you've worked with, what are some of the really interesting concepts that you've learned about, and can you share some of your favorites with our audience?
Yeah, I mean, the car companies, the automotive companies, they're all hedging their bets. They're all looking into different ways of powering people around the planet. You know, the airlines as well. You know, the shipping companies. Obviously, some of the most practical ones, the ones we're beginning to see, are hybrid technologies where you have gasoline-powered engines and also electric power at the same time. Electric power is suddenly becoming very widespread in cars. In the area of London where I live, they've just started to put electric power points into the streets. I mean, literally in the last 2 or 3 weeks. That's really exciting. And then fuel cells are another exciting technology where hydrogen is converted into electricity and water inside a car's engine. So there's no polluting exhaust whatsoever. You just need hydrogen, which is one of the most abundant elements on Earth. There's other technologies which are probably perhaps a little bit further away, like solar-powered vehicles are a possibility, although I don't think the technology is quite there yet. But, I mean, basically, we are seeing a lot of activity, particularly with automobiles, to wean us off gasoline, to wean us off fossil fuels. And you know, I think it's going to become a reality faster than anyone thinks. As soon as the cost of an electric-powered car or a fuel-cell-powered car comes down beneath that of a gasoline-powered car, then gasoline will be something from history. It'll be like the horse and cart.
Thank you. Now, you also write about Mazda City, where they're just doing so many amazing things there, and the city is designed to accommodate 40,000 people. Do you think that, considering what they've done there, that that's something that is actually feasible for other areas of the world? And you know, is it possible to even make that transition from the way that things are now into something similar to a Mazda City?
Yeah, and the Mazda City is in Abu Dhabi. It's in the Arabian Desert. And as you say, the idea was to create a zero carbon city. This was a city, like a whole city, that had no net consumption of energy. I mean, just an unbelievable project. They've started already. Some of the districts are finished. The thing is about Mazda is they're working on a clean patch of land. You know what I mean? They're building a city where there was no city before. The problem we have in existing cities is you've got all this legacy of old, you know, brick buildings, timber buildings, concrete buildings that have been sort of cobbled together over the last 100, 200, 300 years. In some European cities, maybe like 800, 1,000 years. It's very difficult to turn those cities into clean cities. Not only is it expensive and involves ripping out a lot of fabric that's already there, but, you know, you can't just clear away historic cities. So I think that the Mazda is a model that could be replicated in certain parts of the world where they need vast new cities to house lots of people. And in China, they're doing very similar things. They have also plans for huge cities of, you know, 100,000, 200,000 people that will be green cities, cities that don't waste any resources at all in theory. But I think in developed societies like yours and ours, it's going to be a lot tougher. We have to work with what we've got. We have to make sort of small incremental changes.
Thank you. In regards to the whole collection of designers that you've worked with, what have you personally taken away from this whole tremendous opportunity. I mean, there's so many wonderful things to learn about in this book. It doesn't matter what your interest is. There are just so many beautiful designs here. What have you incorporated into your own home environment from everyone that you've worked with?
Well, I think what I said earlier on is something that I really believe in, is that, you know, that I try not to follow fashion too much, you know what I mean? I try to choose things that I really like and keep them. So a lot of the things that we have in our own home are, I've been around a bit, to be honest. They're sort of, there's things that my parents have that have been handed down to us. Our entire house is pretty old. There's quite a lot of original features that haven't been touched where we've been able to get away with it. I wouldn't describe myself as a green guru or I'm not a person who people should follow in terms of my green lifestyle. I'm a journalist who wrote a book and learned a lot from reading that book. I think the biggest thing that I did learn in the process of writing the book and in the sort of the time since then is that the notion of green design has gone from being something which was a kind of a fringe activity, almost considered a bit of a hippie weirdo thing, even just a couple of years ago, to being absolutely mainstream. And I think that, in a way, I believe and I hope that the idea of green design will quite soon disappear, because it will be the default position, that design will be green, because designers are caring people, architects are caring people, that actually the opposite of being ungreen will be the thing that people talk about, that it will be normal to do green design, that all good design will incorporate green thinking, sustainable thinking into it, to the extent that we won't even use the phrase green design anymore. It will just be design or good design.
I couldn't have said it better myself. And by the way, you are so incredibly modest, especially since you were named Architectural Journalist of the Year back in 2004. So for someone who just simply writes about design, you're quite humble. And you do have quite an eye for design, if I do say so myself. I mean, now, some people view some really horrific-looking things as art, but, you know, the things that you've written about, you have a really good eye. And I think anyone who buys a copy of Green Design, Creative Sustainable Design for the 21st Century will definitely find something in here that they can incorporate into their own home environment or even in their office environment. There's just so many beautiful and even motivational concepts here that just really want to make you get out there and get moving.
Well, thank you very much. And I did try very hard with the book. I mean, we had a lot of conversations with the editor when we'd sort of say, well, look, this design is really doing a lot for sustainability. But then we'd say, yeah, but it's not beautiful enough, is it? Why should green design be ugly? So, yes, we have tried very hard to fill the book with things that not only sustainable and green, but beautiful and desirable and things that we will respond to and would want to have.
Marcus, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It has been wonderful talking to you. Can you share with our audience your company's website and also your social media information so that people can connect with you on social media?
Sure. Yeah, the company I run is called Dezeen. Our website is www.dezeen.com. That's DEZEEN. It's a blog about architecture, design, and interiors, updated every day with, you know, furniture and buildings, not just green stuff, all kinds of stuff. And I'm Marcus Fares on Twitter, but you're probably better off following Dezeen, which is at Dezeen, DEZEEN.
Thank you, Marcus. And for those of you that are big Pinterest fans, I'm sure that you are going to love all the wonderful images that are on Marcus's website, and by all means, pin away. Folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Sawyer with the Clean Energy View Radio Show. Have a wonderful afternoon.
Thanks, June.
Thanks, Marcus.